Ready to take your verdicts and jury selection to the next level? Jury consultant Harry Plotkin and trial lawyer Dan Kramer are your ticket to tipping the scales before trial begins. You're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Picking Justice. We got a big one today, Harry. We have a social media influencer, now a famed author. Unfortunately, it's not Jake Paul. I know that's who you're looking for, but we have the great Bob Simon here of many 7- and 8-figure verdict fame, won all the awards. Bob, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well to quite well, my friend.
Okay. All right.
Better than the last, you know.
That's great. So you got a book out, huh?
Yeah, dude, it comes out, I think, pre-orders now, then January 28th, year of our Lord, 2025. The day before I turn 45, actually, this will be published.
All right. So by the time this airs, it's going to be out there and everyone's going to be buying it. It's going to be sold out.
Yeah, they had to do, there were so many pre-orders that they had to do more prints and delay the, yeah, so it's been good.
What's it about?
So it's called Defeating the Disc Injury Defense. And it's literally talking about how you win all these disc injury cases. And it's like the run-of-the-mill ones. It's a lot of the ones that we all try, like those light to moderate impact rear-end car crash cases where they say that they got degenerative condition, that they say that they can't be injured, not enough force. Bills are too high. Plaintiff lawyers are in on the conspiracy. All that shit is...
liens, pre-existing, attorney referral. It's just like this playbook.
Yeah. So it's like the book is literally how to defuse all those bombs from like intake through discovery through trial and just how to reframe the case. You know, it's like... if every lawyer can do this, because, you know, Dan, you operate like I do. We get a lot of referrals from other lawyers, and sometimes they've already made the case worse by running away from pre-existing conditions rather than embracing and trying to hide prior stuff. And it just doesn't play well. But, you know, hopefully this book empowers all those lawyers to do things right from the very beginning because it makes it way more valuable.
That's great, man. Do you talk about jury selection in the book at all?
I do. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, we'll go over some of the tactics that I talk about in the book probably today. I know Harry and I have talked about this extensively. Dan, we probably do a lot of the similar stuff because we try these type of cases all the time.
Yeah, man. Well, that's exciting. I can't wait to read it. I got to order my copy. Can I get one signed?
Yeah, dude, I'll sign it for sure. And put my in blood. Right. Nah, but it's you tried one of those like no impact cases. I remember a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
They're so hard because it's like you have such an uphill battle. Play it right, you can get it done.
Yeah, no, those are, I mean, no matter what you say, those are very, very tough cases. But people try them. And I love seeing newer attorneys take a crack at them and getting out there in the courtroom and trying those tough cases because you learn more from trying those tough cases than the huge impact, admitted liability, of, you know, clear objective findings, all that stuff. You learn way more trying those low impact pre-existing condition, aggravation cases.
And it's like, if you do it the right way, because I've had a lot of these ones, and we'll talk about jury selection, is if you don't run from your bad facts, but embrace them and make them so desensitized to the property damage issue that it's a big red herring, that, you know, makes it much easier for you to win those cases. You said those cases that we all try are the hardest ones because they have every bad fact against you that we all have to fight, right?
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for lawyers if you have one of those like low impact rear enders where your plaintiff actually threw the neck roll on at the scene of the crash? Or is that coming in like the advanced 2.0 edition?
Yeah, that's advanced.
I think your 2.0 should be like even worse facts. Like, you know, how do you turn a 3-figure case into a 5-figure case or 6-figure case?
The next book I'm going to write about is how to like send me the really easy cases, you know, that are just layups rather than let's pick apart the hard one.
Just call it Don't Fuck It Up Trial Guides. Bob Simon. So Bob, one question I have, jury selection. I mean, I've been in trial with you and you do an incredible job. One of the things I think you do so amazingly is like, you know, you bring your personality into the courtroom with you and you find ways to build credibility with the jurors, especially conservative jurors who are sitting there thinking like, you know, what is this bullshit? This is some bullshit PI case and everything. And within just a few minutes, you do a few things to kind of get them saying, okay, this guy's a straight shooter and all that kind of stuff. Tell me, what do you do to make your voir dire go from like your average sandwich to throwing some fries on that sandwich, Yinzer style?
Yeah, the Manny's. I like that. I like that reference. My wife still puts French fries on her salads because of that stuff.
Oh, well, nice.
Harry, you actually did research for this episode?
Oh, no, I know about Fremontis and the Pittsburgh fry sandwich. Yeah.
Yeah, I like this. No, I think you conservative jurors, I think, can make excellent jurors, except for they can't be conservative on one thing, and that's limits on damages, on having artificial cap that they can't give. You know, I frame it sometimes as, you know, some people feel this way and it's okay that, you know, that pain and suffering, that intangible, that human harm, that emotional distress is just the cross we bear and you can't compensate it. And some people say, I will give zero because that's who I am and that's okay. So I think you want to be able to kind of frame it that way and let them know it's okay to have these feelings and like to validate it. But I like to get into with those conservative jurors. And I remember one specifically that we had, Harry, in a trial that we did in San Bernardino a few years ago, where he literally walked in with a Trump t-shirt on.
It was a Let's Go Brandon shirt.
Let's Go Brandon.
And it was a second day of jury selection. Like yeah. He wore something else the first day. It might've been like, you know, one with like guns or something on it.
Are you sure he just wasn't hoping your brother was going to be there, Bob? Are you sure that really wasn't, he did some research on you?
No. Tried one case, I had a handful with Brandon, my brother. And I remember one time that idiot tried to pour water right before my closing and spilled the water all like one of those big pictures all over the table, all over me. He was just so shocked. I just stood up and the jury was laughing. I'm like, little brothers. Am I right? You guys, am I right? No, but conservative jurors. So, you know, what I do with him is you want to kind of get them. They want to do what's just, what's right. And it's like a piss off factor, right? They want to be able to, it's crime and punishment. If somebody screws up, they got to pay. And if someone's trying to fool you, that's fake news. So embrace it and be like, juror number or whatever, I always try to remember their names. So, you know, we talk a little about like this with the judge, you know, I just got to ask you, like, you seem like somebody that's a real good, like BS detector. You know what I mean? They're like, yeah, I know what you mean. So I was like, so somebody's on the stand. It might be my client. And you think my client's a liar, a cheat and a fraud. Could you like say zero? I'm like, yeah. If you find that other side of the table screwed up and they got to pay, will you give them full compensation? Like, will you be able to do that? And I'm like, yeah, I think I could do that. And then to start preconditioning them for what I know they're going to have an expert up on the stand that's using junk science, or that I know, because you're subliminally telling them, hey, find that red herring. If you find like somebody is just trying to fool you, just write in your notes and take that into consideration. Because I think those jurors really like to have little breadcrumbs and clues. And yes, I'm strategically making them find it for themselves. But if they feel like they came to that conclusion, it really empowers them to do the right thing. On another trial where I literally had a lady in her 80s that was the president of her Republican group. And she ended up being our foreperson. We had a huge verdict. She wrote me thank you notes. She still writes me Christmas cards. I didn't get one yet this year, so I hope she's okay. But Mrs. Botson spoke directly to her about, you know, her father owned a trucking company. It was against a trucking company. I was like, yeah, as you sit here today, are you like, it's a trucking company. I can't do that. That's what my dad did. You know, you're a little girl. Your dad was on the road a long time. And I always drop in that my dad was a trucker. I tried to get in there a little bit like that too. And you start like getting into her emotional state of when she was a kid, who her father was. And I was like, did your dad ever tell you those stories about the truck drivers didn't do stuff the way they're supposed to be done? She said, oh, yes, they did. And the defense thought this was going to be like one of their best jurors. And the defense never brought up the worst fact that the trucker hit these ladies in a car, my clients, and then left. He tried to leave the scene and they caught him. And the idiots never brought it up in jury selection. So I intentionally picked a conservative jury, again, crime and punishment. And whenever I brought up that this guy left the scene, it was a hit and run, I said in my opening statement, I remember Miss Boss, that conservative juror, she went like this, looked right at the defendant, was like, oh, the case was over. It was done.
Let's break down a little bit. I mean, one of the things that you said earlier, which I think is huge, and a lot of lawyers don't do it, is like, when you're telling them, if you think that my client is a liar, a fraud, or a cheat, or what those are the words you use, I know, something like that.
Yeah.
You're not just asking them a question. You're like also telling them like, hey, I'm reasonable. Like, I know that happens. Because these jurors are coming in there and they're like, I'm sure there's a lot of bullshit cases. Like, and you're basically telling them, yeah, you're right. I mean, this just isn't one of them. And so as long as you kind of acknowledge, I think, that elephant in the room, and you can't build credibility if you're like just this one-sided, like every case is great and McDonald's case is great. And if you're telling them like, yeah, there's fucking people out there who lie and cheat, and there's people who exaggerate injuries and milk the system and all that stuff. And that's totally true. And if that's my client, send them home and kick them the heck out of here. And they're like, okay, this guy gets it. Yeah.
I get angry. I say those cases make me feel angry too. I think that's terrible for our system. I think it's a drain on our system, all that stuff. I kind of try to be like them. They are on those cases because everyone should hate those cases.
Yeah. I mean, frivolous cases. Yeah. I raise my hand too. You know, I think that helps with these jurors, right?
Yeah. Who thinks lawsuits, too many lawsuits, who thinks they're out of control? I always raise my hand. Yeah. There's a lot. And it's silly because people can't like come to agreement on reasonable things. And that's why we need you, right? But no, but I think that's, you don't run from that. And we're in LA, like when I try these cases, and it's like, we have so many lawyer billboards. And I bring that up. I was like, you know, who just has that icky feeling? Like, who already thinks, hey, this guy's an ambulance chaser. They just want cash. And someone raised their hand and said, like, see, give me the hate. Just tell me, right? And then you laugh and you talk about it and you say, and it always, it ends up where the judge will interject and be like, this isn't one of those fraudulent cases. And you sit back there and smile. Thanks, judge.
But I think they also, the jurors think, the conservative ones are thinking like, okay, my idea of like this manipulative, like dishonest plaintiff lawyer, ambulance chaser, they'd never bring this shit up. And then the fact that you're bringing it up and acknowledging it head on, they're like, okay, this guy's different. I mean, showing jurors that you understand how they feel is a huge part of building credibility, because most lawyers just put their head in the sand and like avoid talking about those things, right?
So Bob, let me ask you real quick. So do you ask directly, like, who's already thinking this is a billboard lawyer case, or I'm an ambulance chaser? Are you asking them how they feel about you directly, or like, what's the way you introduce the billboard lawyer?
We heard the facts of the case, and you know, how many people think like there's too many lawsuits? I do too. And you know, people see a lot of lawyers and there's this negative connotation. That's okay. I mean, some lawyers probably deserve that. Who thinks right now as we sit here, like, we haven't even heard the facts, like, man, raise your hand. These guys are just here for cash. This is like a lottery for them. Like, this is just a money grab. And if we do, let's talk about it. And I always bring up this phrase, you know, as a judge in Texas told me, if you talk, you got a chance to walk. So talk to me. Don't hold it in. So that's good. I always start off with kind of a, you know, mini joke. And this is how I try to find good jurors right off the jump is, you know, I say my thing and be like, you know, the judges heard, we heard a lot of jurors that couldn't serve. They had something in their life. They tried everything they could. We saw a few of those jurors try everything they could to get off this jury. But who here is like really excited? Who wants to sit here for the next 2 or 3 weeks and make a decision? Raise your hand. And most people will laugh, and you always get one or two people. Yeah. And those people end up being really good plaintiff jurors because they just want to be there to do the right thing, to be empowered. So you talk to them and say, why is it important? And now they're empowering the rest of the jury. You know, this is my civic duty or whatever they want to say. And we all have better things to do. And the defense will try to get rid of those jurors. And those other jurors remember whenever they kick somebody off a jury that wanted to be there. You know, and I always say, thank you. You sound like you'd be an excellent juror for this case. We would love to have you on here. And you move on to somebody else. And that's when I really go to somebody that's probably the defense might get off for cause. And I know it's someone that's already crying about this happened to their husband and they can't be fair. And the judge is already giving signals that they're going to kick them off for cause. And you know, you're going to, why fight it? So I just go right up to them and say, you know, we want a fair juror here. And I hear, you know, we need a fair for the other side too. And, you know, hearing what your husband went through and what you're going through today, you know, hearing that if you're going to hear similar to what my client went through, and this is totally okay, can you be fair? Or you're already saying, you know, I feel so bad for the plaintiff. And they'll say that, say, do you feel sympathy? And that's okay. Like, yeah, I feel sympathy. And I explain a little bit of sympathy or empathy. And I'll say, you know, I would stipulate to the defense that it's probably best that you not sit here through this trial, that even though you'd be a great juror for us, we want a fair juror. And always take the defense off their heels. Like, oh, we can't stipulate to that right now. Whatever. Like, we'll talk. But then I'll go to a juror I know is bad for us. I know it's bad for us right away. And be like, we just heard from sympathy for Mrs. Jones, you know, how she couldn't be fair. Could you have sympathy for, like, the defense? You know, say that there was a $100 million verdict that was just. And I'm not going to ask for $100 million, but just say $100 million. And you'd be like, would you be, I feel sorry for the defense. How are they going to pay that? I feel sympathy for the defendant. And if you were on this jury, you're like, no, I just can't do that because I feel sympathy for them. Now you're reframing because you know the defense is going to get up there every single time and try to get jurors off for sympathy for the plaintiff. I get it out there right away, sympathy for the defendant, because we're trying a lot of these cases that aren't against corporations. You know, they're against individuals, human beings. The hardest cases to try, if you have like a really nice teenage girl on the other side as a defendant that's so sympathetic, you have to hit that head on, because the jurors are thinking about, I don't want to stick this poor girl. She has her whole life to live with a huge judgment, right?
Harry and I tried that case, 16-year-old boy, really nice in San Mateo for 6 weeks. Yeah. That's like all we talked about. I think pretty much the whole time is appraising the true value. Not, do you know where the money's coming from? Should it matter? Do you know if it's insurance or not? All those things, you got to like hit head on.
I see some lawyers that never touch that. And it's like, you're going to get crushed.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell them what the law is and the judge is going to read them. So why do I have to worry about, you know, you're like.
And then you go hit all your bad facts. Like it's jury deselection. You get rid of the bad jurors. And you just go lose it like a focus group. If you're blessed enough to give a mini opening, go through, you know, you're going to hear this fact. Like, how do you feel about that? Do you automatically think, you know, I mean, God, if my client like waited 6 weeks to get treatment based on that fact alone, I'd be like, nope, I don't need to hear the facts. I'm done. I already made up my mind. Do you feel that way? Like,
well, hold on. I want to break that one down a little bit, Bob, if you don't mind. So delay in treatment, obviously it's a fact a lot of us had to deal with. How are you, you're introducing that in your mini opening, I assume. You're weaving that into your story in mini opening. And then how are you following up with that in your question in Voir Dire?
Yeah, so whenever I do mini opening, I will do it where, you know, in California we can do that. Other states you cannot. But if you are allowed to do it, I always say, you're going to hear this facts. We think it's a very straightforward case. It's this. But you're going to hear the defense are going to bring up these points. And I need to know how you feel about it. One, we're going to ask you for $15 million. Like, if the judge doesn't tell you not that you can't do it, say it right away. We think a lot of evidence are going to prove that it's going to be a $15 million case. My client had pre-existing degeneration in their spine. They had spinal surgery, and the doctors are not going to get paid until the lawsuit pays out. They have what's a lien on it. They're going to find the lawyers referred the client to them. They're going to say it's not enough force of an impact to cause an injury to somebody in a car crash case. And I go through all of those bad facts. I say, now we have a stark disagreement on those, but I need to know how you, the juror, feels about those facts that we're going to talk about. And then I get into it, right? That's in their mind. Say, and then I'll say, you know, we heard about what I said in mini opening. Are there any things that stick out to you? Be like, man, if the car ain't hurt that bad, the person can't be hurt that bad. Do you feel that way? And then get them to start talking. That's kind of like my mindset for it. I think knee-jerk bad jurors are going to be ones that have had felt they were wrongly accused or taken advantage of in a car crash case where they're never a good juror. I've tried it so many times, but it's, even if they sound so nice on paper, but they rear-ended somebody, I'm like, they just got so much money and I had to go file a lawsuit against me and all this stuff.
I like to ask you two different ways. I'll ask, you know, anybody ever been unfairly sued for a crash? And that's one thing. And, you know, you'll hear the horror stories, but then a different question, anybody ever been at fault in a crash, but then the other person claimed, you know, inflated their, how much they were asking for. And then you get a whole different group sometimes of people talking about those, and you got to ask both of them. I've seen a lot of lawyers tell me, I mean, I remember one time I was working on a admitted liability case. And I said, the one question I want you to ask is, anybody ever seen anyone fake or exaggerate an injury or anything like that? And the guy, and the lawyer was like, I'm not asking that question. That's going to poison the pool. I would never ask that. And I was like, you know, well, you're going to probably lose this case. So, I mean, you got to ask that, right? I mean, it's crazy that some lawyers will run from those things.
You got to be armed on the law too. Like, be present. One thing the lawyers make a big mistake of is they try to do everything. They're trying to take notes while picking the jury. You can't do it. If you're picking the jury, I always have my co-counsel with me, and I'll have Harry there too. They're taking detailed notes on things that can get them off for cause. That's your main objective, and not have to use a strike to try to get them off for cause. And like Arizona, for instance, there are no peremptory challenges. They're all for cause challenges. So it's even more important. And those judges are very well trained on the law. But a lot of judges you're trying the case in front of are not trained on the law for cause challenges. So you have to make sure that is, I always have a pocket brief with me that has the exact case law and stuff in case I need to cite it at the sidebar. But you have to have somebody taking those detailed notes, because when you're talking to someone, building that credibility, you want eye contact. You want to be active listening, you know, hearing them bring something up and then following up on it, just being in the moment, because that's what your job is to be. And I always just have a checklist of stuff I want to go over that I can reference here and there, but be present while you're talking to everybody. Because if you're missing stuff and you have to look at the whole panel, because you can, the nonverbal stuff is huge. If he's just nodding their face to somebody when they're talking about ambulance chasing lawyers and too much money, you see Grandma Jenkins in the back going,
Yeah, it is great working with Harry or Claire, because you get these post-its that is like literally verbatim. And even if you don't have real time on there, I'm like, man, they like—
Oh, for cause, yeah.
Yeah, on cause, they just give it to you. But then you know if you didn't set it up right, because like this, I didn't lock in the wording and Harry's trying his best to get the quotes like all, you know, on the post-it. But if you can't, you know, if the case doesn't warrant a jury consultant, like Bob says, have your co-counsel there, your associate, your paralegal, someone just to kind of jot down just the lines you need that is taken directly from case law, strike against, uphill battle, whatever your jurisdiction is, find that exact wording, because it's great. I mean, it's really all you really need under the law. You show it to the judge, you're like, look, they said exactly this on the quote, and then the judge really should be locked in. If not, you got a good appellate issue.
Exactly. But remember, if it's an appellate issue, you got to strike all the jurors.
I was just going
to
say
A lot of people don't know that, is you have to use all your peremptories to say that you were unfairly, because they're like, well, you had another peremptory. You could have hurt that person. But that's why it's very important to educate the judge and to belabor it a little bit. And then to preempt, you know, the defense is going to do. Defense gets to go after you and they're going to get up and say, but can you follow the law? If the judge instructs you, can you follow the law? And I'm like, well, yeah, I could follow the law. But that's not the standard, but judges don't know that. So but you got to do it before the defense gets up there and say, look, if Mr. Defense Attorney gets up here and asks you, you know, we were just talking about this and you said you couldn't be fair and you needed more evidence to support more than a preponderance. You needed like overwhelming evidence if you're going to award $10 million, right? That's what you said. But if the defense lawyer gets up here and says, can you follow the law? Can you be honest with him and say, you know, this is my true feelings. This is how I feel. You know, or are you just going to say yes to every question that he asks? And it kind of empowers them to not just say yes, like a robotic yes to every single thing. But that's the hardest thing to do because jurors just always put their tail behind their legs, a lot of them, and just say, oh, yes, I can be fair. Yes, I'll listen to the judge. Of course, I'll listen to the judge.
The way I like to do it to get them prepped for the judge or the defense rehabbing him is to say something like, what I'm hearing from you, tell me if I'm wrong, is that you're telling me that, I mean, you're a fair person, right? And I'm sure you would try your best to be fair. But is what you're telling me you have feelings are going to make it, like, even if you try your best, it's going to be a struggle and you might not even be able to do it. If you get them saying, yeah, that's basically how I feel. I've seen it when the judge or the defense gets up there. But can you follow the law and my instructions? They go, you know, like I told Mr. Simon, I can try, but I just don't think I'm going to be able to do it. Trying is not going to be enough. If you can get that in their heads, then judges start, okay, we've got to let them go and everything. So you got to give them these little stupid tools and dealing with the defense tricks. But it sounds like, I'm sure your book is full of all the defense tricks. I mean, you see the same ones coming over and over again in spinal cases. Any ones that you see, tricks that the defense does in voir dire that you like to preempt? I mean, they do, you know, they always hit sympathy and they always hit, we go second and can you wait, you know, but any particular things in spinal cases that you like to preempt?
It's the ones that you said, and I do like the where they talk about, we get to go second. I always hit that on the head. Like, we as a plaintiff, we have what's called a burden of proof. You have to prove it. Like, they haven't proved anything yet. And I say, if we don't prove anything, can you give us zero, right? But if we do prove it, you can give us the full amount. Okay. And then one thing is, you know, defense gets to go second, last, right? Their evidence. So can you really pay attention to like what we're talking about first when I put on my case? So that when you go to render your verdict, oh, we just heard from the defense's story. I forgot what the plaintiff's, you know, because we have to go first. They have it's like the benefit of going second. Because the defense, they're so wired to be like, going second is worse. It's like, well, now you flipped it on its head. Sympathy thing, I was hit that hard on having sympathy towards the defendant, flipping that on its head. They always bring up corporations. And I tried so many against that same guy we had out in San Bernardino. And I know his.
Yes.
Okay. So I always preempt it and be like, all right, I'm going to ask you, can you be fair to a corporation? Can you treat them like a person? And they kind of laugh because they know that the defense lawyer may have already gone once and done it. So you go in the alternate. So you just, let me ask you some questions. You literally check off the box of all the ones they're going to ask. And then you sit down. The defense doesn't know what to do because they get up on its hand. It's like, objection. We just heard this, Your Honor.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, I think that's a good segue into prehabbing. And it's one of the biggest things since I've started working with Harry is prehabbing your good jurors, especially in a corporate defendant case, right? That's a big concern is that you're going to get, especially nowadays, man. I mean, with everything going on in the news, like you're going to get jurors who are pissed off at corporations and just want to hammer them no matter what. And so how do you insulate those before?
And let's talk about the other thing is health insurance, medical care costs. I mean, the stuff that's happening recently, you know, we're in December 2024. Nobody trusts health insurance companies. They know they just deny claims. And this is a big sword for us because, you know, we've been doing this for so long and fighting, like, you know, if you have an attorney, you're blessed enough to be able to like have access to medical care right away and not have to wait 6 months for an MRI, like all these things. So that's a huge benefit. So it's a sword that we use rather than running from it and be like, no, attorney referred treatment is a concierge service for people to make sure they get the treatment that they need.
And lanes,
Who thinks freedom of choice is important, right?
I use it as a class argument when I have a indigent plaintiff who has to treat on a lien, didn't have Medicare or whatever that was really bad, couldn't get to doctors, and then they hammer him that he should have not have gone to these top doctors in Beverly Hills who are charging, you know, $200,000 for a fusion. What they're saying is our client's not good enough. He should have waited a year. He should get the cheapest care. He should go to the average doctor because he's a below average person. But you know who the CEO's going to if their spine's in a wreck.
Exactly.
And then it's just like the jury gets so mad about that.
And then this is where you poke them during your case is whenever they always have some sort of, you know, the expert or billing expert that'll get up there and say the bills are too high because you could do X, Y, Z and you could get this for this amount or this is what the lowest level will pay. And then you get them to kind of say like, well, you know, you doctor, would you, if a person came to you that didn't have the means to pay, they didn't have cash up front, they didn't have insurance to pay you, health insurance, and they came to you and they needed spine surgery, like, what would you do? And it's very hard for them to answer this question. And like, I had one guy say, well, I'd, I'd send them to county hospital. So you wouldn't be able to treat them, right? Because you wouldn't take that lien. Oh, so you send a county hospital. County hospital, that's where they train their residents, right? They're like, yeah, that's where they're training residents. So do you think it's fair for my client to not, because you're apparently really good at what you do. You're like the best. You told this jury how great you are. You would not be available to them. You would say, go to county and have some residents practice on my client's spine. And man, you could hear like the jurors get.
Just to save the defendant money for what they cost.
Exactly. You know? Just for a discount medical care.
Yeah. Right?
Let's do that.
No, it's great. And then another thing on that note, I know this isn't specifically jury selection, but on all those doctors, you go into their website. They have to, by law, now put up what kind of insurance they take and like all that. So you find out, and often you will see the type of care, like Bob saying, that they want our client to go through to get cheaper care. They never offer. So it's, again, it's like, well, so the defendant wants to pay you, but you know, they're saying our client's just, again, not good enough for their guy.
To tie this into jury selection is you are laying these traps when you're asking these questions about cost of medical care, because you know it's going to come into evidence and it's going to remind those jurors about the stuff that you talked about.
So how do you do that? How are you planning that? Like, what's the exact word verbiage you're using?
So when you say, you know, we're talking about cost of medical care, it'll be a thing in this case. We're going to tell you that they got to pay what's owed. This is where they should be able to have access to the best care. They're going to talk about other rates that other doctors may take, and maybe I'll call it discount care or whatever, you know, and say, will you evaluate and listen to the experts and who's talking and say, should the doctors be able to get paid the reasonable value for the services, or should they just take like the lowest amount that they say? And they might object and stuff like this, but you're planting the seed. Say, well, can you listen to the evidence and see who should be afforded, like who are you going to listen to, right? Because when you get there and they're going to be like, oh, fuck this guy. Like, and every doctor that's worth their salt on the other side, I always ask them, could your practice survive if you just took Medicare rates across the board? I'm like, well, no, of course it can't. And then they call the billing expert to say, give them Medicare rates.
Man. I've never done this before. What do you guys think about? I mean, would you ever consider in voir dire talking to jurors in a case where you have liens or whatever, saying, you know, hey, juror number 7, Ms. Smith, have you ever had a doctor offer to, you know, basically say, hey, instead of you having to go through insurance or whatever, you know, how about you pay me, you know, describe a lien? And the juror will probably be like, no. You know, like, is that something that you would be open to? And, or would you just say, no, that seems weird, or I wouldn't want to do that? And, or would you rather, you know, if you were presented the option of like, hey, you could get a really good doctor and you don't have to apply to your insurance company, would you reject that or no? And they, I'm sure the jurors will all be like, no, of course I'd take that.
Well, yeah, you know? But you talk to them, say, who's had to go through, had frustrations with their medical care or their coverage or health insurance, having things denied. People raise their hands and say, you know, what's the longest you ever had to wait for something? You like had to see a doctor that would be like months. And say, would you hold against the doctors in this case that the doctors that I was able to refer them to got them in right away? And they also put it on what's called lien, where they would say, we're not even going to get paid until the case resolves.
I wonder if you could even say, like, is anyone going to hold it against the plaintiff if you heard that they, and I would, this is how I might describe it, like, if they kind of like went around the insurance companies and found a better way. I mean, and, you know, like cut out the health insurance process, because most people, if you frame it that way, they're like, why wouldn't I do that if I could, you know?
I do want to play devil's advocate. I mean, the lien thing also, if we highlight it too much, then we're kind of playing in the defense sandbox a little bit, right? I mean, like, is it really something that we need to talk about that much in jury selection?
I think we have to talk about it so it's out there. And then I usually put it when in my opening statement, I lay out all the red herrings. I say, you're going to find more, but one of them is this thing called a lien. And you're going to find in the industry, all the doctors do it, and they do it to help out people that are in this situation so they can get the best medical care. And they're going to hammer this home. And you're going to be thinking in this case, like, be like, so what? I'm telling you right now, it's a red herring. So that's out there. And every time they bring it up, it's like, well, here we go. We're going to talk about a lien. All right. You owe it paid in full, right? And the defense doctor, you've taken liens before. Yes, you have. And you'd agree they needed the treatment. Yes, they did. So why are we even talking about it? And it's almost like the jurors are like, we're wasting so much time with these red herrings. And I power them so much. I have a whole red herring slide. And I definitely leave a lot out because I want them to find them. And then I'll say in closing, here's some red herrings that I saw. You can check your notes to see if you found them too. And it's like this, 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 and they love it, right?
Do you ever get objected to on talking about red herrings in opening? Is all argumentative?
All the time.
So I figured,
No, but you do it. I mean,
I'll just be like, the experts, the defense experts are going to say X, Y, and Z, and then just disprove it. And then either way, you get away with what you can, right?
Yeah. And there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do that, because it's what the evidence is going to show.
Right. Exactly. It's the whole defense. They're going to come up there and say that in their opening, right?
And once the judge says, you can't say what the defense is going to say. I'm like, yes, I can. She's like, you don't know what they're going to say. I was like, we took all their depositions. I know what they're going to say. And I'm actually going to play some of them in my case. Whatever. But yeah, the pre-rehab of the good jurors is one of the biggest things you got to be able to do, because you want to keep them on the jury. And you want to tell them, like, when they hate corporations, we see this all the time, and they think they're all BS and stuff like that. Preemptively tell them, say, you know what, this might be, some corporations you agree could be good. They'd be like, yeah, some are good. And say, some are terrible, right? We've heard the horror stories, yes. Now, as we sit here today, you don't know one way or another, is this like one of the better ones? Or is this like one that has a lot of philanthropy? Or is this one of the really bad ones? Could be completely different, right? So I know you don't like corporations, but can you just wait till we get to the evidence? You know, I just want you to be fair to the other side. Can you wait and, you know, make sure and just shake your head with them? Like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Say, because, and in my case, my guy might be the biggest cheat ever. And like, if you find like they're a cheat, you could be like, yeah, they get zero because they're a liar, right? There's no way I could side with you. So you want to be able to prehab that and then be like, you know, so they hand you the law and you look at the law, you got to treat a corporation like a person. But if it's a bad person, you could treat them like a bad person, right? But if it's a good person, you treat them like a good person. Cool. I have not seen a defense lawyer be able to get off a juror for the corporation thing. I think it's pretty hard, especially when you ask them those type of questions and the judge actually helps you out because they try to do the same thing. I'm trying to think what are the big issues that the people...
Well, before we do there, after this little break, I do want to talk about your theory on specific dollar amounts. But before we do, we want to thank our sponsors. First off is Baldwin Settlements, fantastic structured settlement company with the founder and owner, Melissa Baldwin, who gives back all the time to the plaintiff's bar with CALA, CAOC, AAJ. She really is the go-to structured settlement company in person. Baldwin Settlements, they work with clients to really get them set up for the rest of their lives. I worked with her on the big damages case. We represented someone who was seriously injured, but his demons, he was a drug addict, kind of in and out of homelessness, got him a big settlement. And she was able to speak at his level and convince him that he needed to have a structured settlement to get himself set up for himself and, you know, his siblings who were taking care of him for the rest of his life. And she's just able to really relate to these clients. And not only does she relate well with the clients, she's very accessible. I mean, she will text, call when she's on vacation, nights, weekends, which is what you need with a structured person. She can deal with mediators, the other side's structure person, and she can also get great rates on attorneys for their fees. So I highly recommend the Melissa Baldwin, Baldwin Settlements, very dear friend of mine and a huge supporter of the plaintiff's bar. So Baldwin Settlements, thank you for sponsoring.
And for their contact information, just reach out to Dan or I at Picking Justice if you want contact information for any of these folks, because they're amazing. Our other sponsor, Motion Lit, I mean, they do it all. They're technically like a trial technology company, but they do what? Settlement docs. Let me know if I'm missing anything, Dan. Settlement docs, trial technology, animations, graphics. What am I missing here? I'm sure there's a couple other things.
I mean, I've worked with Motion Lit for a very long time. Vahe and Vache, they're wonderful people. They really understand what it takes graphically to tell a plaintiff's story in opening, closing, any imaging you need, animations. We use them a lot for surgery animations because not only are they really good and accurate, they have a great team of animators, but they're also affordable. Frankly, like their prices are hard to beat. And we've shopped around, you know, but we love Motion Lit. We love their work. Jurors love their animations. So they got all tech support, depositions, like you said, settlement videos. Their animations are fantastic. Just really good people to work with. And they're huge supporters of the Plaintiff's Bar. And I think it's important, the business partners that we team up with, that they support what we do and our causes and all that. And Motion Lit has always been there for that. And they're just really good to work with. And just like Melissa Baldwin, they're very accessible. And just good dudes. Vahe and Vache from Motion Lit.
And involved in the Altadena fire litigation because they actually lost their office in the Altadena fires. Their office was in Altadena. So get in touch with them for that case or any other trial that you got coming up there at motionlit.com. And they're terrific.
Yeah, no, they're great. And then our final sponsor, who's new to Picking Justice, Four Corners. It is a deposition summary company. We have been using Four Corners in my office for, God, it's probably been 8 years, maybe more. Really just a fantastic company that they will summarize your depositions quickly. We literally, every time we come in a case, because we get a lot of cases referred from other lawyers where depos have been taken, we just immediately, right away, send them all our depos and we get these great, accurate summaries back quickly. And they just make it so easy for any firm, frankly, that is litigating cases, but especially trial firms. If you have a case where you have, you know, 10, 15, 20 depositions, you really need a good summary so you can get up to speed quickly. We love their summaries. I mean, Frank, KTL, this is the, I mean, we use them for every single case, all summaries. We trust them with the work. They're quick, they're affordable, just really good, like I said, good people to work with, big supporters of the plaintiff's bar as well. So Four Corners, I highly recommend getting all your depots summarized by them. Even on cases that you have, as soon as we take a depo, we have a standing order in our office that as soon as the depo is done, as soon as we get the transcript in, my team sends it to Four Corners, get summarized, and then boom, we are just ready to rock and roll for trial or preparing for other depositions. So Four Corners deposition summaries, fantastic. Harry, you have the contact information for them?
I do. Yeah. If you want contact information for Four Corners and their owner operator, Sheila, who is amazing. Yeah. Reach out to us and we'll get it to you.
All right. Thank you to the sponsors, Baldwin Settlements, Motion Lit, and Four Corners. All right. Let's get back to the show.
All right, Bob. So now we're back. I do want to talk. I'm always really curious. We ask all the guests about money and jury selection. I noticed you said in your mini opening, you'll say like, we're going to ask for $15 million. Is that your philosophy now, is to give the specific dollar amount you're going to ask for early?
If I can, I will. But I also have to be sure about the plaintiff and how the evidence will come in. It's hard to use a specific number and then your client gets impeached 10 ways to Sunday and then try to stick to that number for credibility purposes. So I'll say millions of dollars are substantial and I'll just start the talking process. Last case I tried with Harry, I told him we were asking for like $40 million or something. I forget the number.
Yeah, that was a death case, but yeah.
It was a, you know, a son that lost his dad. It was a single son. There was no, I mean, it was a loss of a son for his father. And I think kept saying $40 million. And I remember the jurors were talking about it and like, well, yeah, if you prove it, I could give it. And it was just, they said it so many times. And we ended up selling the case right before closing. And the judge went and pulled all the jurors. I'd never seen anything like it. And she asked each one of them how they felt about the evidence and, oh, we would have done so well. But it was a hard liability case. But anyway, we would have done well. One of the jurors, I'll never forget, he was like, man, when Mr. Simon said $40 million, I'm thinking during jury selection, that's a crazy amount of money. I could never do that. And he's like, but then I listened to the evidence. And he looked at my client. He's like, I would have given you $40 million. Crazy, right? But if I hadn't laid that anchor, I could have said $50 million, $60 million. I could have said $15 million. I said 40, and because the jurors do not know the value.
I know. So what's your philosophy? I think I've come around. I say many millions is usually if I'm allowed to say millions. A lot of judges out there are really starting to go pretty far afield and won't even let us say millions, which is crazy. But even if I could say a specific number, I just don't know if I would. I kind of like keeping to the imagination. So I'm curious your philosophy on what is the benefit of saying 40 million as opposed to tens of millions or many millions?
I think it's anchoring and let them say, you know, you're so confident in your number and you're going to prove it and that's what you're going to say and you're going to stick to it. The one light impact disc injury case that I had and got 17 million on it, I said 15 million for pain and suffering over and over again. Said in jury selection, got jurors off because they couldn't even conceptually be there if the car was not even that damaged at all. They couldn't conceptually be there. So many people offer cause because when you're talking about $15 million, no damage to the car, who's like, this is a fraud, I'm out of here. Like, let's talk about it. And I got a lot of jurors off for cause because of those two issues, the low property damage and asking for $15 million. And the jurors gave $15 million of pain and suffering to the penny on that case, and the rest were specials.
But there's got to be a place you obviously do it in your jury. You got to build up credibility, I think. Where are you starting to ask for money in your voir dire?
Right away.
Okay. This is the thing I love about doing this podcast is you get so many different, this is why it's an art, not a science.
But if I love my client, I'm going to do it right away and I'm going to stick to it. If I'm a little wobbly on how the facts are going to come in, or I know my guy get impeached, I'm going to say many millions or substantial. But if I'm sticking to a number, I'm going to say it mini opening and I'll talk about it. I'm going to say, you heard me say that 15 million. It's a lot of it's like that emotional injuries, right? Does anybody here think that emotional injuries are just not real, that we shouldn't compensate them for them? And usually I'll turn to somebody in the military because they know about PTSD, they know about emotional injuries, I get them talking about it. And then I'll ask them, do you think somebody should just, in order to have PTSD, do you think that they had to be in a war or be in the military? Or do you think they could do it in a car crash or something like this? And it gets them talking about that type of issue. And then we get to somebody that I want to try to get off for cause and say, you know, you heard many millions or whatever substantial amounts of recovery. The judge will instruct you. She'll say more likely true than not true on that issue, on every issue. Is that the pain and suffering, the emotional damages? That's what it's worth. Now you, I heard you say a little bit that you're not okay with that. What do you need to be proved to you in order to award that kind of money? And this is where you can get them on the burden of proof, because be like, do you need way more than 50.01%? Is it I need clear and convincing, like that criminal standard. Like for you to give that kind of money, or are you just like, you know what, I'm never going to do it. And I'm like, yeah, I need to see a higher standard.
I think with that, that's really good. It's a good way to spectrum it. It's like, okay, if I'm asking for 5 million, now I need 55%, 10 million, it goes up, and the percentage goes up the more you ask. Then you've got the scale and all those people, if they're truly bad jurors, because maybe they all might not be because they just don't really understand the concept yet of awarding that much for pain and suffering. I think you should technically get those all off for cause because, right, Harry? I mean,
yeah, but be careful with it because I found that like almost every juror feels that way. Even right. The good jurors feel that way. I mean, even a great juror will be like, yeah, I mean, if you're the more you ask for, I think you should prove it more. So it's kind of a tool that you can use if there's somebody who you think is just biased and you can't quite get them, nail them down. That works totally well, but I wouldn't keep going with too many other people because you're going to lose a lot. And then the judge, as I see it snowballing, is going to step in at some point and go like, oh, no, I'm going to fix this problem. And, you know, that's not what the law says. And you're going to follow the law, you know. So, but definitely use it selectively. Don't just ask everybody on the panel that question because you're going to get a lot of hands.
Yeah, I just try to do that off a juror that I know will be bad for us. I'm just trying every tool I can to get them off for a cause. Maybe it's the money thing. Maybe it's the sympathy thing. Maybe it's whatever it may be. I'm going to try to get them off of the jury.
But definitely somebody who's struggling on damages. Yeah, who's giving you like, I don't know. And I have an issue with, you know, I could listen, but these big damages kind of do rub me the wrong way, but they won't give you cause and they won't say they're unfair. But yeah, that's like the best way to get in on them and go, do I have to prove it to you?
And Harry, you and I have talked about this many times, but I think that is the issue that I think a lot of newer or inexperienced attorneys will make is that they'll hear someone say, I just don't think I can award more than 5 million, but they hedge on it, right? They're not 100% sure. They don't know. This concept is so new to them. They've only learned it for 10 minutes, right? And so they don't know yet. And I think some attorneys will just take that answer and then try to lock in cause. And maybe they do, but they could have lost their best juror right there because
yeah. I mean, it's usually not, you know, who a bad juror is going to be with you sometimes with the judge asking questions. Then you walk them down the line to get them off. So it's just use every tool you can so you don't have to burn a peremptory. Like the number one thing of jury selection is finding the bad people and getting them off and then pre-rehabbing your good jurors to try to keep them on. You know, we need 9 out of 12 in California. If you get 3 strong jurors for you that are plaintiff jurors, they can sway the other 6 that you need. So you got to protect those. And that's why strategy is so important. That's why I always have a jury consultant like the Plotkins with us, because you got to see what's coming up. You got to see what's on deck. You got to know the next 20 people coming and the ones that are likely to be off or to be on. Because if you have some 3 home run people sitting and that's up on deck, you can kind of be willy-nilly with some peremptories, right? Defense got a lot of problems. But yeah, I think it's much easier for us to try cases these days because of what's out in the media and the amount of money that's out there, the amount of lawsuits that we see every day from politicians, right? The stuff about healthcare that's out there all the time and the junk science. All these studies that these experts rely on right now are so much easier to defeat because people are now very weary about what are the sample size of these studies because they hear about it all the time, right? Like this is all like who's making up these studies? And I asked their experts, how many people, you just cited these studies, let's go through them. This one had 2 people. Who are the 2 people? The authors of the study. You think that's reliable, right? Let's go through this one. And then I ask a juror, like, who thinks, you know, this one kid, he was like doing statistics. And it was like, your statistics. Like, yeah. I was like, is sample size important? He's like, very important. Why is that important? And I remember as soon as I asked that question to that person and he had a sample size of 2, he looked at me, he was like, writing it down.
Yeah. And well, again, this is not necessarily jury selection, but I think that's why it's so important. You got the biomechanics, you got all these human factors. I read every single word of their studies. I have to look up a lot of the words, but then once you start really getting down to it, you're like, they tested 4 people from the 1940s who were 21-year-old males from the Navy. And they're saying that my 67-year-old female has the same spine and therefore the forces are going to be the same and the outcome's going to be the same. Only one of those people complained of neck pain and a 7-mile-per-hour delta V. It's like when you really get in those studies, it's like, that is fucking nuts, man. It's nuts. Plus, it's from the 70s and, you know, they were using totally different technology in cars or whatever. And that you just can't compare that to a 67-year-old. And then what you do is you ask their neurosurgeons or their orthos, is that a fair comparison? Does someone, does a 67-year-old female have the same spine as a 21-year-old naval officer? You know, it's just, it's a gift.
Yeah, well, we talk in the book about pitting experts against each other and asking all those questions because they always answer them a little bit differently. You know, one big thing to talk about in these disc injury cases when you're trying cases is embracing the pre-existing condition. and then the unusually susceptible plaintiff. And I do that in jury selection when you talk about, you know, do you think the law will provide, Your Honor will instruct you that if somebody had a pre-existing condition that was made worse due to a car crash or made symptomatic, that they have to be compensated fairly for that. And I got to ask you, you know, do you think that that's fair that this person over here didn't know that they had this pre-existing condition and it made worse? Like when we were in law school, it was called like the brittle bone disease. If you tap somebody with a car, usually it can't hurt them. But if they have brittle bone disease and it breaks their arm, they have to be compensated for that. Like, how do you feel about that? Right now you're hitting like this theme that you're going to have in the trial about embracing pre-existing conditions. They still got to pay from jury selection on and empowering the jury. But that makes sense to me. Yes, they have to pay, even though it doesn't sound like it's fair to the defendant in that moment because they didn't know that they could hurt somebody that bad. But that's how I get them thinking that in those cases as well.
I actually just started using that kind of question. And it's really, the thing is, you want to find out the bad jurors based on who thinks it's unfair to the defense that this is the law, right? That the law says they're responsible for all the harm, even if it's $10 million, $20 million, if they aggravated or made something worse. Does anyone think that's a little unfair to the defendant that they didn't mean to hit someone who had these pre-existing problems, you know? I think couching it as unfair, then you'll find out jurors who start thinking that way and already siding with the defense. I love that.
Yep. Yep,
but you could ask them, you know, like frame it like kind of a good way and see, you know, like, does anyone here think that there's such thing as a safe crash where like a safe crash where it's like, you know, nobody could possibly be hurt? Because some people will say like, there could be a baby in that car. There could be an 87-year-old grandma in that car who just got surgery. There could be all kinds of things in that, you know. So is there anything as a safe crash where, hey, you know, you hit someone and it's like, I shouldn't have hurt anybody? Because that's what they're really saying, right? They're saying like, oh, you know, there's some crashes where it's just like unfair. Like, how could somebody possibly be hurt? In a big crash, obviously, pre-existing is not a big issue. Because I think jurors are like, wow, if you crash into someone like that, you should be expecting someone to walk out of there with something seriously injured. But for like, you know, 5 or 10 miles an hour, like, how could anybody possibly be hurt?
So I know we got to wrap up here soon, Bob, but just kind of a final thought. What's something that you used to do that you absolutely don't do anymore?
I don't try to ingratiate myself with the jury too much anymore. Like when I was young, I thought you had to like get them on your side for everything and ask them like, you like rom-coms and all this. It's not a rapport building exercise. Yep. You weave it into the questions you're doing for a cause or making it personal to the person you're talking to, but it's not like jury selection is not about you, the lawyer, right? It's about the case. So stick to that. And yeah, you can put your personality into it. And jury selection for me is the most fun thing. It's like stand-up comedy for me. I don't like when they have sometimes they'll give you a lavalier mic. I just like to hold a microphone in my face like I'm a stand-up comic. I don't know. It's just like a thing for me. I have to walk around and make a joke and get them talking. If I only had to do one thing the rest of my life, it'd just be picking jurors. I love it. I like the psychology of it. I like the strategy of it. And I like...
Harry, are you hiring? I mean, you know, are the Plotkins hiring?
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, if I offer Bob Simon as someone, I think I get quite a few takers. So let me know.
Simon Plotkin, we charge 10% of attorney's fees. We'll come in, do the focus groups, and pick the jury for you.
That's not a bad gig
Send any emails to myself or Bob. So no, I'd love to do it. So
that's a big theme. You know, we've interviewed charming people like yourself, you know, Gary Dordick, all those. And he kind of said the same thing that back in the day, you know, because Gary's just really good, you know, just great with people and all that. But he used to just try to just charm the socks off everyone and realized, did he really learn anything about that juror? And so that goes for everyone out there. Maybe you don't have the best jokes. Maybe that's just not your personality. That doesn't mean you cannot pick a great jury.
Yeah, I mean, you have to let them talk. If you're talking more than them, you're doing a disservice. Ask open-ended questions. Unless you're trying to get that yes or no for cause, open-ended. If you watch bad jury selection, just watch any in-house insurance company defense lawyer and say, by a show of hands, who cannot be fair? All right, by a show of hands, who doesn't like corporations? It's like, what are you learning here, dude? Like,
yeah, exactly.
I know, I'm sitting there, I'm not taking any notes. Jurors aren't saying anything, you know, and we're like 20 minutes in and like, they're just talking at them. And
yep, talking at them.
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, on that note, Bob, thank you, man. Everyone get his new book that's coming out. What's it called again?
Defeating the Disc Injury Defense. And it is published by Trial Guides. Yeah, 4 years in the making. I had a couple of radiologists wrote a few chapters in there because we go through the anatomy as well. So I wanted people to, and also to verify a lot of the stuff that I talk about is it's medically sound. Like the ways that I categorize stuff and talk about things. We have a lot of MRI imaging. Like I like diagnostics in this case and how to use them when they're good and how to defeat them if they're not so good. And of course, jury selection, themes, all that fun stuff. But I think the critical point to all this is, you know, tell the human story. Like that's how you win a lot of these cases by letting the jury know your client's a human being and how they suffered, and making it very much like how the jury is. One thing you learn of jury selection, you learn so much about these folks that these people are now your audience and they want to be able to root for your client throughout the trial. So I try to find similarities to those 12 people in the box with my clients. So by the time they take the stand, there's things that they liked in combination of each other. So it's making it real for them. I remember one lady, like, she used to go to custom car shows or antique car shows with her dad. I made sure as hell I brought that up because I knew my client liked to do that with his son. I remember how emotional she got talking about that. So that's why you have to be active listening and have other people take notes during jury selection, because you get, that's where you get the dollars. That's the big psychology that you should be paying attention to. And I stay every day after trial, I'll look at my 12 jurors and I'll say, how can I make this special for them today? I'll look at it. I'll know them so well. I'm looking with Facebook, Instagram every day, learning something new about them and dropping seeds throughout trial. So it's almost like a big game of inception.
I love it. That's brilliant stuff, man. Thank you, Bob Simon. Check out his podcast show. Same, I don't know, Bourbon to Proof. It's excellent. Really good stuff. He's got great guests on there. Really appreciate it. Thank you to Law Pods for making this all possible and bringing this education to the people who help our clients. So thank you. Until the next time, Harry Plotkin on Picking Justice.
Good to be here. Thanks, guys.
If you're enjoying the podcast, the best compliment you can give us is sharing it with a colleague who would find it valuable. For all the best clips from the podcast, follow us on social media. You can find those links in the show notes. Have a jury selection story to share? Email us at podcast@pickingjustice.com and we may address it in a future episode. Until next time, remember, you're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.